I invite you to join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life, spirit of a beautiful spring morning, spirit of a community gathered together in aspiration, in thanksgiving, in awe, in service, and in hope. Be with us in this hour that we have set aside to save and savor, to redeem by finding meaning in the day-to-day occurrences of our lives. Be with us as we seek to heal where we are harmed, where we are broken, where we are sick, where we struggle. Be with a spirit of beauty as we seek to find beauty within ourselves and in the world around us. Let us each be held by the presence of that spirit which has existed from somehow before the very first moment of time, as we hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our first reading is chapter 52 of the Tao Te Ching. It is written by the ancient Chinese sage Lao Tzu and translated by Stefan Stenad. The world's beginning is its parent. To have found the parent is also to know the children. Although you know the children, cling to the parent. Until your last day, you will not be harmed. Seal the openings, shut the doors, and until your last day, you will not be exhausted. Widen the openings, interfere, and until your last day, you will not be safe. Seeing the small is called clarity. Holding on to the weak is called strength. Use the light to return to clarity. Then you will not cause yourself misery. This is called following the eternal. Our modern reading is an excerpt by the prophetic contemporary writer Annie Dillard from her spiritual reflections on nature found in her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Our life is a faint tracing on the surface of mystery, like the idle curved tunnels of leaf miners on the face of a leaf. We must somehow take a wider view, look at the whole landscape, really see it, and describe what's going on here. Then we can at least wail the right question into the swaddling bank of darkness, or if it comes to that, choir the proper praise.
So I'm pretty sure that the year was 1958, give or take a little, not too much. My father had just acquired a Kodak Brownie 8 camera. The Brownie 8 had been around for a few years, having gone on the market in 1951, but we were never the first on our block to have any new technological sorts of things. It hadn't been all that many years since we'd got our first television set in our house, and now we had a movie camera. That was something. But at the age of 8, I wasn't altogether sure just what that something was or how I should respond to it, how I was expected to respond to it. I do remember very well the first filming session that we had with that Brownie 8. It was staged out on our front porch. I'm not sure if my memory has been more informed by the actual original experience of that day or by the countless times over the years and decades since then when I've been reminded by the historical record as it was projected on a tripod fold-up screen that we would set up in the living room. Not very many years ago, one of my sisters had a couple of hours of those old home movies made into a VHS format, and several of us gathered together in her house to re-witness the performances of our childhoods. Now we had graduated to watching ourselves being projected on a large screen TV. Together we watched our histories. There were birthday parties and holidays. There were graduations and weddings. There was the arrival of new babies brought home from the hospital, both of younger siblings and of nieces and nephews. There was a lot of footage of us ice skating. The 10 Ortman children were ice skaters. The footage was of us skating in our large outdoor rink in the backyard that spread over our yard and a good portion of the neighbors, because ice skating was probably the one single activity that all the Ortmans enjoyed. Those movies provided the best chronicle of our growing up through the years, right there, out on the ice. One of the most highly treasured segments that we saw was some footage that my father took in the fall of 1960. An enormous motorcade complete with fire trucks and squad cars and police motorcycles, all with their sirens fully blaring, brought presidential candidate John F. Kennedy to my hometown, and that motorcade passed right in front of our throng-filled 17th Street where my home was. My father stood with his Brownie 8 camera on the rise out at the edge of our lawn, and just as Kennedy's convertible went past, my father hollered, "Hey, Jack!" And the president-to-be turned to see who had called him, and he gave that great famous smile of his, and he waved with all of his vim and vigor, and we saw it then, and we saw it time after time for years after as John Kennedy looked directly into the Brownie 8 camera that my father was holding there. But already I've gone rather far afield of that first experience, the one on the front porch that I wanted to tell you about. My recollection of it goes something like this. It was the late afternoon of a pleasant summer day. I walked into our living room, and the front door was standing open, and through the screen door poured all kinds of excited squeals from my younger sisters who were out on the porch. "Come out, come out," they shouted. "Dad's got a movie camera. He's going to take pictures of us, and we'll all be in the movies." I didn't want to miss an historical event like that, so I went out onto the porch with them, and my father was standing out on the yard, still fidgeting around, orienting himself to his new camera, and he hadn't started filming yet, and the younger kids were running back and forth from one end of the porch to the other, and I was just sort of hanging out with my brother and a couple of our older sisters, and finally my father announced, "Okay, I'm ready. Here we go." Now, you need to understand that I had been the object of my father's lens on numerous occasions before, not with a Brownie 8, but with a still camera. And one of the things I'd learned about from those sessions, probably more painful than any of my siblings, was that if my father had a camera pointed at me, I had better not move for any reason in the world a single muscle in my body. So when he proclaimed, "Here we go," the 8-year-old me stood perfectly still in the middle of the porch while everyone else was mugging and waving and walking and running around. Can you picture it? "You guys are going to get it," I muttered as loudly as I could, trying hard not to move my lips. "You're going to get it. You'd better stand still or this is going to get ugly fast." "Don't be silly," they laughed at me. "These are moving pictures. You're supposed to move. You're not supposed to stand still." I looked out towards my father, trying to read any clues that might be helpful in avoiding his wrath. He didn't seem to be slightly dismayed by the total breach of usual picture-taking discipline. What the heck, I thought. And so our very first home movie was of this frolicking carnival-like scene on our front porch with all of the other kids going this way and that way and having a grand old time. For all of eternity, though, in whatever digital format that video might eventually be saved in, my part in that first home movie is that of an 8-year-old child of the 1950s, complete with crew-cut and striped T-shirt, multicolored, standing perfectly still for a very long time, only eventually daring to raise my right arm into the air and wave to the camera by flexing my hand open and closed. Being shy has never really been a part of my nature, not even as a child, but trying to stay out of trouble, now there was a pastime I engaged in all the time. Some of you here are around my age, or as unlikely as it may seem to others, are even older than I. I wonder how remarkable your early experiences of home movies may seem to you now. For many of you who are younger, there is likely no period in your life that's passed without video recordings as a part of it. For all of us, though, there must have been some kind of premiere performance, a first time when, through some version of home movies, each of us started to become aware of how we appeared to the world around us. I wonder if for you, as it was for me, that was something of a daunting experience. Seeing ourselves in videos is an odd and unnatural experience in many ways. Throughout all the ancient religions, even the gods were unable to see themselves in actions. You know, the God's eyes that different native religions made? Those were so that God could see God's self, because not even God can see God's self. For untold millennia, humankind has acted in the world in ways that have included reflection on the impact of our actions. But only for the past 50 or 60 years, that's been mixed significantly with more attention being focused on the impact of our reflection, the impact of our image, as it has been captured through the lens and onto moving pictures. I suspect that humankind has always, always struggled to distinguish between things and the appearance of things. So what might be in the mind of an 8-year-old child stepping into a new age of experience where the old rules no longer apply? Home movies give us some significant evidence that previous experience will have a lot to do with how we embrace new experiences in our lives. If the past has been fraught with danger, the approach likely includes a fair amount of trepidation. If it hasn't been so dangerous, though, then perhaps our approach has the greater capacity for confidence. Things versus the appearance of things, trepidation versus confidence. It seems that these are significant dynamics along any path towards a spiritual maturity. We are in a continuous process of everything being new all the time. If we aren't experiencing it to be so, I suspect that we're not really paying attention. None of us has ever been here in this very moment before right now. And that is something that I believe is always true. Given our constant status as initiates, as newbies, how is it that we might learn to focus on the essence of our experience and not get all tangled up in the appearances of our experience? How is it that we might learn the lessons of our past in order to face our future with the greatest confidence that we're capable of? So when our senior lunch bunch met 2 sessions ago, Horst Heuer suggested a topic for the next gathering. Let's each answer the question, he said, what is the most important thing that you've learned? Think about that question for a moment. Well, it's a great question. Everybody loved it. And everybody came to the following session, which was just this past Tuesday. Everybody came prepared to share some incredible learnings that they had gleaned along the way. And when Septua and Octo and Nonagenarians start talking about the most important things that they've learned in the course of their lives, there are some very rich lessons to be shared. It was so wonderful just to be with them up in the Pearls Room as they shared these treasures with one another and with Judy Tomlinson and with me. But the gift of Horst's question was even richer for me. It became the genesis of a 2-week odyssey that I suspect and hope will play a significant role in all the remaining years of my ministry and even all the remaining years of my life. So as I began, my response first was the thought, how can there be any one thing that's most important? How can it possibly be boiled down to one thing? I've learned a lot of important lessons along the way. I've learned how to be unfazed by the roving eye of the video camera. I've learned how to endure some of life's more brutal moments and how to walk with others as they've learned their own capacity for endurance. I've learned to hold someone's hand while they've lied quietly or not so quietly on their deathbed. I've learned so many things for which I'm grateful, and how could I pick one single thing as the most important? And finally, I realized that I needed to choose something on a meta level. I needed to choose something large enough to incorporate those other things that I've learned. And so then I started thinking about a recurring theme that's been in many of my messages to you over the years, words that you've heard me say over and over again, the words awe and gratitude and service. And those words started coming to mind and tumbling through my thoughts. And eventually, those words emerged in a phrase that I believe does represent the most important thing that I've learned in my life. And that is that for me, the examined life, the intentional life, the life of integrity is one that includes discipline, the spiritual discipline of being open to and engaged in awe and gratitude and service. So then one night last week, while I was away on vacation, I woke up in the middle of the night, and the thought that woke me up was, the greatest of these is gratitude. Awe requires that we pay attention in and to our lives, that we pay attention to each other and to the universe around us, that we are here, that any of this is here is truly amazing, and it's beautiful and it's awesome, and sometimes it's also tragic and painful and nearly unbearable. But all of this is here, and because it is, we are here. And that we are, even including the pain and the suffering in our lives, that we are, is amazing and beautiful and awesome. To be open and engaged in awe is to pay attention and to be aware. And from the experience of awe, it's a very short step into gratitude. We've done nothing to merit our being, and yet here we are. If our hearts are filled with awe, how can they not then be filled with gratitude for this experience of being? Sometimes in the midst of grief or great challenge, it's hard to be in touch with that gratitude. But even in our gratitude, or the vision or the hope of our gratitude, even then we can be pulled through the transformation that we need to undergo in order for us to learn to live with our grief or with our challenges. It's either gratitude or the idea of gratitude that can pull us through that experience. So if our response to awe is gratitude, it's yet another short step from gratitude into openness and engagement in service. If we have been given all that we have, all that we know, if we've been given all that we even aspire to, how can we help but to respond with service to that which has been so generous to us? And since we can't know who or what that source is, since we cannot know, our service must be to that which we do know. Our service must be to those with whom we share this planet and to the planet itself. Gratitude is the central point. It is the bridge that leads from awe to service and then back again from service to awe. Being grateful means that we pay attention and that we are aware. Being grateful is as natural as breathing in and out. It is engaging with integrity and doing our part as co-creators of this amazing world, giving back to the universe, which has given us everything. Gratitude is the birthplace of faith. It is the birthplace of hope. Gratitude is the birthplace of love. I can't tell you how many times over the years people have said to me, and there are people in this room who have said this to me, I wish I could have the faith of a devout Christian, or for some people it's of a devout Jew. I wish I could believe that there was some kind of a safety net, like the loving arms of Jesus, that I could fall back into that would hold me like it holds those who have such a faith. But I can't believe in those things, and so I can't have that kind of faith. Well, the truth is, people who have such faith as that, at least the ones that I know, didn't come by it easily. They worked to develop that faith. They worked to develop it over the course of their lifetime so that it might be there when they need it. And even then, even when they need it, that faith is tested. I'm not saying that we need to mug for the camera. We don't need to mug for the camera. I'm not saying that we need to try to believe in any theology that is someone else's. I am saying that as Unitarian Universalists, we need to believe what we have to believe because it is what we have found and what we find to be true. As near as I can tell, a truth which is as universal as anything else that I have discovered along the way is that the practice of gratitude yields a grace that is capable of enabling us to transcend any challenge, any difficulty, with confidence triumphant over trepidation, with a sense of authenticity triumphant over any illusions of integrity. If the past has been fraught with danger, our approach to what lies ahead likely includes a fair amount of trepidation. If we come prepared, though, then perhaps our approach has a greater capacity for confidence. Awe and gratitude and service, and the greatest of these is gratitude. In the face of illness or injury, let our answer be gratitude. In the face of financial loss or the loss of a job, let our prayer be for gratitude. In the face of the loss of a loved one even, or our own impending death, let our guiding light always be gratitude. Let gratitude not be a mugging for the camera, nor of being frozen in fear that we might not get it right. Let our gratitude be versed in our daily practice, the spiritual discipline of an orientation that leads us from awe to service. So that even if, like Job, we would lose nearly everything that mattered to us, we would not have lost our most precious connection linking us, linking our lives with the universe around us, we would not have lost our gratitude. What greater, more fulfilling way might there be for any of us than to arrive at the very final breath of our lives with our hearts filled with gratitude for what has been, and even for what still is. If we are willing to work towards a faith like that now, I trust it will be with us somewhere, somehow, in the very darkest of our moments yet to come. Our life is a faint tracing on the surface of mystery, Annie Dillard wrote. We must somehow take a wider view, look at the whole landscape, really see it and describe what's going on here. And then we can at least wail the right question into the swaddling band of darkness, or if it comes to that, choir the proper praise. And so I ask, if you could, and surely you're the only one that possibly can, if you could, how would you want to script the authentic home movie of your life? May our proper praise ever be this, the simple and heartfelt prayer of gratitude, of thankfulness. Amen. Annie Dillard also wrote, "The answer must be, I think, that beauty and grace are performed whether or not we will or sense them. The least we can do is try to be there to appreciate them."